Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your broken face of music news and critical commentary. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff.
Float your photo down the stream. Take a mercy shot at mercy. A poet's dream. The glowing seeds have grown dizzy.
And we track back 14 months ago to a moment when Beyoncé's self-titled album suddenly came upon us. John Pareles reviewed it immediately for the New York Times, and we sat around this table in this same room at the Times office and had this question.
I think one presence on this record who remains a mystery is this guy named Boots.
Yeah, what's the deal?
Who he produced, or he wrote and produced a couple of songs, but a lot of the credits say additional production by Boots. I wonder if he's the one sort of nudging it in the direction that makes it a little more coherent.
Has that person been outed at all?
I was going
to
ask you guys.
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, he has. He's on Jay-Z's label. He's on Roc Nation.
Yeah, but...
He had a SoundCloud page with...
Do we even know his real name?
Beyoncé Knowles.
I've seen a photo online.
Okay.
And I've forgotten the name.
So that person is providing the overall
I have the feeling he's holding it together.
Yeah.
And okay. She is too. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's clearly in charge. I mean, this is what she wants to say.
John Pareles, we're talking about Boots. You said back then, I have the feeling he's holding it together, with reference to Beyoncé's self-titled album. You just went and met the man in Los Angeles.
In L.A. and in Joshua Tree, yeah.
And you uncovered some of the mystery. You got the answer to these questions.
Well, I got the answer from him, but it does seem I was stumbled onto the correct answer back in the Beyoncé time.
Okay, well, before we get to the question of whether or not he held together the record mm-hmm. in any sense, and even what that means, who is Boots?
Well, he's a 28-year-old guy who came from Miami, played in a bunch of bands, a total music geek, basically. He loves the Beatles. But he played in a bunch of bands in Miami. He made his way to Brooklyn. He's a disciple, in a way, of LP, who's the rapper who's half of Run the Jewels, Company Flow, producer, rapper, really smart listener. LP is his mentor, I guess. And LP
you
is
mean
a guy
one-to-one
who,
or long distance?
One-to-one. They're friends. Boots said that he's the one objective ear he trusts with his own productions.
Right.
But you can see what he's learned from LP, which is rapping, which is putting together rock and hip-hop techniques. He was doing it himself, though, too, beforehand. He had a couple of bands in Miami. One was a band called Young Circle, which was the kind of indie rock band that has three drum kits set up on stage, and they'll bash on the drums for a while and play some loud guitar and do some dance beats and do some hard rock beats. You can hear the formative
that
thing.
Kind.
That kind of band. you can hear that. Then he had a band that seemed like a more conceptual project. It was called Blondes. He had a girl singer. He had this sort of retro songwriting, Motown, 50s flavor to it, with all these crazy things going on in the production. And I realized as I was researching the story that I'd actually reviewed Blondes in a playlist mm-hmm. when he was calling himself Jordy Asher, not Jordan Asher, as he's credited on Beyoncé, or now Boots.
What became of Blondes?
Blondes were a pretty good idea that was done better by Lana Del Rey, which is what Boots told me now.
Meaning some sort of...
this sort of retro plus modern.
Modernized retro.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He gave up on Blondes. He started making his own demos as Boots. And somehow, the story that he will not tell, though I tried the thumb screws and I tried the intoxicants... the story he won't tell is how Beyoncé heard this song he wrote called Onto You.
And this is a song that is not from any mixtape or album or whatever. It's just a song.
It's a song.
Somehow
he had,
Beyoncé heard it.
He had decided to make a solo album. And this song was going to be the center of the solo album. This song was like, I'm proud of this. This is a sound that I can expand out into an album.
Was it his manager who got it to Beyoncé?
We do not know.
This is some agency stuff.
I asked him if it was Solange, because Solange is hip and gets stuff to Beyoncé,
sure.
But it wasn't Solange.
You know that conclusively?
Yes, he said no. I tried. I really tried. Anyway, mysteriously, Beyoncé hears this song falls in love with it and says, you know, come talk to me about, you know, what else do you do? And so...
Yeah, fair enough. Talented guy. But, okay, so then where does that lead?
That leads to a week of songwriting. That leads to a week of let's work on this. He brings her some songs that he thinks would be good Beyoncé songs, and she turns them down and says, no, I want that song that was for your album. The songs he had written for himself turn out to be better for Beyoncé than the songs he was writing for her. She convinces him to give up this song. He says, this song was my heart, but... I actually heard his version of it, which was a complete track, and the Beyoncé version, I think, is better.
And we're talking about the song?
The song Onto You, which became Beyoncé's Haunted.
Haunted.
The mood setter for the Beyoncé album.
Okay. Well, before we get any further, we opened up, obviously, with Boots himself, a song, Mercy, from a sort of strange entity, which will be commercially available soon. We'll talk about that in a second. But okay, here is Haunted from Beyoncé's self-titled record, co-written and co-produced by Boots.
Right.
My haunted lungs, ghost in the sea.
Haunted, a really strange track, a two-parter at least. There are at least two parts
yeah.
to that song, right? Think back to when you were reviewing that Beyoncé record, you know, in the early hours of its existence on the earth. You were thinking about this as a, not knowing anything about Boots, as a Beyoncé move.
I thought it was a brave move. I mean, Beyoncé could be slick beyond belief. Very easily, Beyoncé could have hired, you know, the top five guys and had them give her tracks and do a formula record. I mean, there's some of that on that album. There's a Ryan Tedder track. But for her to make this the face of the album with just a few instruments, with this really moody, sad flavor to it, with there's some spoken word in there about how I'm tired of the record companies, radio, it's not going to sell, which... according to Boots, with some of his ruminations at the time, it was a brave move for her. And listening to the album now and having heard much more of Boots, the mixtape he put out, the soundtrack to the mini movie, whatever it's going to be, I can hear him in the rest of the album. But what happened was she invited him for a week of songwriting on spec. That week turned into a couple of more weeks. There are two more Boots songs on that album, Heaven and Blue, for which he shares credit with her. But then apparently she started calling him in to work on other people's stuff, to finish other people's stuff, to do whatever he was advising or mixing or doing to finish the album, to make the album a more coherent thing.
He wouldn't tell you how that initial song got to her in the first place.
No.
But did he tell you why she kept him around? What does it boil down to? Why?
Well, I guess they had an affinity. He liked what came out. She liked what came out. I mean, the way people make albums now, if you're a diva superstar, is I think you get as many production teams as you want to send you stuff on spec. And then you pick and choose and assemble as you please.
Right, but she's really throwing in with a complete unknown. You know, I mean, she's making a major investment of time and energy with this guy.
I think it was a brave move on her part.
Right.
I mean, I think that she wanted to do something different. It's as simple and complicated as that.
Well, let's talk about his aesthetic, his musical language. His songs are spooky, you know?
Spooky is the word. I mean, haunted, you might say.
And in fact, when we talked about this at the end of 2013, John Caramonica said something to the effect of, it sounds like the lost tapes from some Beyoncé album. You know, there's this feeling of like you're listening to the stuff that you're not supposed to be listening to. Ah, it's just an eerie. There's an eerie
sensation.
You're
overhearing something.
You're overhearing something.
that might be one center of his aesthetic. I mean, he's in conversations, he's a real music geek. He loves destroyed sounds. He loves sounds that are accomplished wrong. One song he told me about working on the Beyoncé album, he was working on a drum sound in a very expensive, beautifully appointed, modern commercial studio, and the drums were sounding big and full and precise, and he hated it. What he did was, much to the consternation of the engineer, was say, okay, bring in the gobos, which are these sound-absorbing things, close to the drums, then face the microphone toward the gobos so that all you're getting is the reflected sound. Mm. And that weird muffled drum sound mm-hmm. was the sound that captured the mood that he wanted.
Right.
You know, I'm sure he has stories like this for every sound on his album. He likes echoes and
ghost sounds, erasures, anti-sounds, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of like, I wonder if he's into that disappearing tape stuff, that William Baczynski type of thing. You really got into it with him talking about music.
Yeah.
According to your piece,
yeah.
you talked about krautrock or something.
What yeah, well, he said he was listening to a Can song lately to get going, a 20-minute Can song.
Which one?
You Do Right. Which actually, if you go back to that song, you can actually hear Boots' aesthetic in that too, because it's all sort of strange and broken down and hypnotic.
Hello, Malcolm Mooney.
Yes.
So let's talk for a minute about that first song that we heard. Mercy. It's something that you can see online right now for free at, yeah. what is it, bostonboots.com?
Boots on Boots. Boots,
boots
on Boots.
On, oh, wow. I was reading that in some...
Dyslexic manner.
Dyslexic manner. Bootsonboots.com. You can see that song accompanied by a short film. Explain.
Well, his face is all beat up. His head is shaved. He's bloody. He's wandering through some rural landscape, and at the end he gets hit by a car. Spoiler alert. The song is actually takes a weird left turn. It starts out as this mournful, basically acoustic, but messed up acoustic ballad, and then about halfway through it just slams you over the head. And in the meantime, I've listened to this stuff a lot, so bear with me, but in the meantime, on the way to the slamming you into the head, another drum set comes in from the other side that makes you think somebody's playing drums in the rehearsal studio next to you.
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing all this sort of transformational stuff. He's proud of what he called the terrifying use of volume in this song, because when the guitars come crashing in, you're aware of it and you've probably turned your headphones up too loud.
Mm-hmm.
The film that accompanies it, which accompanies it, is pretty much the endpoint of the thing I watched him in the desert filming. At this point in the film, he's bloody on one cheek. He's got a bloodier other cheek where he's been bitten. His finger's in a splint. He's a wreck. I believe that the rest of the film, which is going to be called Motorcycle Jesus, is not a film. It's a video. The rest of the mini-movie is how he got so messed up.
So Motorcycle Jesus, which will be how long?
Five songs,
so maybe 20 minutes
yeah.
or something like that, will essentially be the prequel.
To Mercy.
Story-wise, to Mercy, which
yeah.
you can see online now.
It's very post-apocalyptic. We're wandering through what's left of civilization with marauding and malevolent forces in an empty landscape.
So let's talk a little bit more about where Boots comes from, because he's a hybrid kind of fellow.
I mean, he's directing this video, and I saw him directing it. I mean, it's not like some guy is telling him what to do. He was framing every shot. He was pushing the director of photography to take weird angles. He's intent on every detail,
mm-hmm.
And he's completely versed in cinema stuff, in music stuff. He lets slip that he has a photographic memory, which probably helps. He's a really smart guy.
So he loves the Beatles. He loves Ken. Who
he
else?
He also loves Queens of the Stone Age, which you can hear in some of his rock ballads. He's got that melodic plus guitar attack.
Mm-hmm.
And he was shooting this video in Joshua Tree because he'd fallen in love with this landscape while recording it. The studio, Queens of the Stone Age, it was Josh Homme's studio.
Mm-hmm.
He's really a cinemaphile, and he said he sees himself doing movie scores, too. I see in him a connection to Trent Reznor, kind of Trent Reznor minus the S&M.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he loves analyzing and destroying sounds. He loves deconstructing sounds. He loves making that normal instrument sound abnormal, which is very much a Trent Reznor move. He also has the skill at making a song a dramatic unfolding, just in sound. It's not the same loop. It's not flown in from the first verse to sound exactly the same at the end. Something happens transitively in his songs. They usually don't end up where they began. And I see that in Reznor, too. And he's also, like I said, plugged into hip-hop with LP. He loves Nas. He's really widely listened and able to put it all together.
It's kind of interesting how quickly he's cut across so much of, well, it seems quickly to us. He's been working at it for a while. But how quickly he's cut across the musical landscape without us, you know, really knowing much about him.
I just think he was smart enough to keep his apprenticeship pretty quiet. I mean, if you go into some of the darker corners of the internet, you can still find Young Circle. You can still find Blondes. He put the mixtape up after the Beyoncé album came out. There was a link from the Beyoncé website so they could find bootsonboots.com. But he's taken it down. So you have to sort of scuttle around some really dark corners of the internet to find the mixtape now. He's got one other song from the mini movie up called I Run Roulette, which is this big, crushing, stomping rocker. So he's very deliberately all over the place. He's not going to let you say this sounds like a boot song because the next one is going to sound different in tempo, different in texture. Every parameter he can shift, he will shift.
We should also mention that he's on the track early on the Run the Jewels 2 album as a voice, at least, and as a producer, as a co-producer for one other track on that record.
Well, he played with them in Madison Square Garden. He walks on stage, pretty much nobody knows who he is, and he does a Guitar Hero thing. He does like a loud lead guitar, just like arena guitar, you know, walks on stage for a minute and 30 seconds and is gone.
And he's done something with FKA Twigs.
Yeah, he's produced albums. He's got albums in the can. With
albums.
Well, one with FKA Twigs and one with this Los Angeles art rock, I guess you'd call it, group called Autolux, which is kind of strange as a commercial entity to go from Beyonce and a million seller to someone like Autolux or to someone like FKA Twigs. Mm-hmm. He was very pleased with what came out of the FKA Twigs sessions. He said it was something bananas, which sounds promising to me.
That's some 2013 slang. He's got to tighten up that game.
He also called it wild, crazy, futuristic. Also promising. One thing I like about him is that he's picking his projects. I mean, he's not being the hot producer. He's not becoming the go-to person for the next R&B singer. He's really picking his shots.
Then he has this mixtape called Winter, Spring, Summer, Fall.
Right.
Which came out before the Beyoncé record, correct?
No, he put it out after the Beyoncé. It came out in like mid-2014, spring 2014.
Uh-huh.
And part of it was to say, if you think you know me from the Beyoncé record, you don't quite. He raps on it. He rocks on it. He has ballads on it. I mean, in a way, it's kind of like a film director's demo reel. It's like, I can do all this stuff. I don't just do romantic comedy. You know, I can do mystery and thriller and whatever, sports. You know, it's all in there. He told me that he put a lot of different stuff on, some of which he loves, some of which he's not so hot on, just to prove that he wasn't going to be in a certain category. He just to prove that he was out of the niche.
Did you get a sense of what he was left with from the Beyoncé experience? Was it a trial by fire? Was it a sort of mentorship thing? Did he have to stick to his guns, or was he completely indulged, you know?
Probably somewhere between sticking to his guns and indulged. Talking to him, he still, part of him thinks, I gave my great songs to Beyoncé. You know, he still kind of misses those songs as his own, but it was the right thing to do. The songs improved. He's happy with it, but, you know, he still feels that separation anxiety, I guess, from the songs.
You mean they could have been better?
Well, no, I mean...
They could have been his.
They could have been his.
He misses them.
But I don't have the feeling that he's been strip-mined. You know, I think there's a lot more stuff there. I think he can generate more. I mean, Mercy, which he considers his best, you can sort of see Beyoncé singing that, but you can also hear him singing it. It's actually nice to have a producer who can sing. How rare is that? Trent Reznor.
But he is living with a gag order.
What do you mean?
Well, there are things he cannot tell you
or anyone
else. No,
there are things he won't tell
about
me.
What went down.
There are things he won't. Talking about Beyonce, what he said was that his previous efforts were all trying to do a certain category, trying to be that indie rock group with the drum kits, or trying to be that retro, cool, modern retro thing with the blondes. And with Beyonce, he finally put the two parts together.
Mm-hmm.
He put the avant-garde weirdo together with the guy who really writes a good melody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what he said was that he finally found himself while making that album.
So she enabled him to be what he dreamed of.
Yeah.
That's a gift.
He gives her lots of credit for pulling the good stuff out of him. He also said something like, if he had been fully in charge of that album, it would have been crazier, but it had a million wins anyway. I mean, and I can see that too. She does have a strong commercial sense. He's a little more of a music geek, but he loves melody. I mean, that's what he gets from the Beatles. That's what he gets from Queens of the Stone Age. He's committed to melody, but he's also committed to songs that take weird left turns in the middle.
All right. Well, we'll go out with perhaps another one of those songs. Adam from Boots' mixtape Winter, Spring, Summer, Fall. And thank you, Jumper Ellis.
Thanks, Ben.
I'm fine now, 'cause there's time now. There is time now. Time enough at last.
That's our show, and thank you for listening. You can read John Perellis' report about his visit with Boots in L.A. last week up at nytimes.com/music, and you can hear some of his music with or without Beyonce, Run the Jewels, etc. on our Spotify playlist. Our producers are Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and we'll see you next week.
Like the leaves on the trees, the salt on the snow.